This week we're in Ireland to investigate the plight of a group of Second World War heroes who here in their own country have been treated more like villains. They fought on the D-Day beaches and in the jungles of Burma, in the Arctic convoys and the African desert. But on their return here, they were vilified and severely punished because they had deserted their own army to fight with the British. In 1945, an official government list was drawn up of 5,000 of them, and what was called a starvation order imposed. Banned from most employment, some even had their children taken away.
Well, I think it is high time that the Irish government showed the sort of maturity that we should expect in this day and age and deal with the matter of the list. I think it's a stain on Irish history. I think it is something that nobody in Ireland can be in any way proud of, and it needs to be addressed.
He had problems sleeping sometimes because of the nightmares of what happened, you know. And yet those men never got the benefits of their efforts.
Oh, they didn't care in the end.
And you were always nervous about people coming to look for you.
We were going looking for work.
91-year-old Phil Farrington lives in fear of the list, the slim phone book-sized directory marked confidential of disgraced Irish soldiers who deserted their own army to join up with the Allies. He's frail now and hoarse of voice, but chatting with me and his daughter, it's clear that nearly 70 years later, he's still haunted by the fear of official reprisals.
Because I remember if you were talking, or I was telling someone, he'd say, don't say anything, because you were afraid the authorities would still be looking for you. Isn't that true?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
What's been the effect on you and your life of being called a deserter?
I was really bad.
I understand that you worry even today.
Oh, I do, yeah.
As that you're a deserter and the army may come for you.
That's correct, yeah.
Do you still believe you might be arrested as a deserter?
Oh, you would. Oh, gosh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yes.
In 1940, after the disaster of Dunkirk, and even though it had declared itself neutral, Ireland could, like Britain, have been invaded by the German forces lined up on the French coast. But when it wasn't, according to Professor Gerald Morgan of Trinity College Dublin, many in Ireland's sizeable army, like Phil Farrington, became restive.
The danger of invasion really receded with the Battle of Britain. So those who joined up then in June 1940 and so on, and were prepared to fight here in the expectation that there would be an invasion here, saw by, let's say, by October, that there wasn't going to be an invasion. So now you had something like 40,000 mobilised people, trained to fight and eager to fight, and nothing to fight.
I think a lot of Irish Defence Forces members found themselves to be underemployed.
Irish Member of Parliament, Gerald Nash.
They joined an army to fight, they joined an army to defend the things that they believed in. And many people believed that what was going on in Europe and across the world in terms of Nazism and fascism was wrong, and they wanted to stand up and be counted.
A view confirmed by Paddy Reid, whose late father and uncle were underage when they deserted to fight the Nazis. In the ranks, he says, disaffection was rife with Ireland's wartime policy of neutrality.
He was one of the first to join up the Irish Army, IDF, 1939. He was one of the first to desert. I spoke to a fellow soldier who knew him when he signed up, and he said, when Paddy and Sergeant Flanagan left, it started a whole wave of desertions, right?
Wish me luck as you wave me goodbye. Cheerio, here I go on my way.
Why did they desert?
Well, conditions were poor, pay was poor, morale was poor. There was a war going on. These are young men. My father lied about his age to get into the British Army, right?
We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering. You ask, what is our policy? I will say, it is to wage war by sea, land and air.
He wanted to be involved, so he deserted in Kilkenny, and I met a man who was with him and still feels resentful that he did that, you know, because he said it started a whole snowball effect of men deserting the Irish Army.
many Irishmen deserted their own shores to fight fascism, some to have adventure. For teenager John Stout from Cork, though, the reason was more basic.
Because we were hungry. They gave us no rations, did. So we got fed up, and I said, well, I went off up to up to Clifton in Belfast, and I joined up there, and I could smell the food up the road. I could smell the food as I was going up the road. It was that good up there. I was 17 that time, so I was well under age, and I was glad to get out of where I was.
Paddy Reid ended up fighting the Japanese with the Royal Artillery in the jungles of Burma, including taking part in one of the bloodiest battles of the war at Kohima Ridge. His son Paddy showed me photos of him wearing his bush hat and leaning grinning on one of the big guns.
He just was so glad that he went, you know, because he felt, you know, that he had done his bit, you know.
Bless 'em all, the long and the short and the tall.
This picture has five soldiers in probably 1944 thereabouts. My dad is there.
Which one is he?
This is him here.
Oh, right.
My Thomas. He signed up in 39. He was 16 when he joined the British Army.
This side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, bless them all.
And I like this one. This is kind of a, all the guys together, you know, the old letter football. You know, they're kind of just memories that these guys all did the same thing, helped each other, served together.
Looking at photos with 88-year-old John Stout, his war was very different.
You can probably hear the snap as they check the lashing on the static line.
A member of the Irish Guards, his tank battalion had fought its way up from the Normandy beaches to Holland to play a leading part in Operation Market Garden, the ill-fated mission to capture a bridge too far, which only resulted in calamitous Allied losses.
Every man out, I can see their chutes going down now. Every man clear. They're dropping just beside a little...
There's a picture there, I think, a couple of pictures there, I could say. So...
That was a terrible action, wasn't it? So many people were killed, particularly paratroopers by the thousands. What did you think at the time?
Yeah, I kind of took my nose a bit, like, you know. I suppose I said to them, down to my age, and my mother saying prayers at home, no Venus at home for me. I said, that's what kept me alive.
You believed that, did you?
Oh, I did. I believed that. That's what kept me alive, yeah.
His mother's prayers may have helped John through the war, where he ended up as a commando, but they couldn't prevent him, on his return home, being placed on the list of deserters, part of the government's emergency powers or starvation order. Punitive measures in the extreme. But then, according to historian Professor Gerald Morgan, while Ireland might have been supposedly neutral, the majority of its citizens were decidedly not.
The partition of Ireland and the disasters in Ireland here... In 1914-19, not only the war, but of the Black and Tans, the War of Independence, the Civil War, and the continuing troubles, these affected every single person on the island and formed their views. I think many people here, of course, thought that Germany were going to win the war. There was a lot of sympathy, I think, for the Vichy government and so on in relations with that. I would say that probably there was 60% anti-British feeling here. And, of course, the Irish had to watch the deserters, 5,000 of them, leaving their own army in their own native land, as it were, and to go and fight in a foreign army, which is technically the case. But they didn't like it, and they hated it.
Sitting today in the Doyle in Dublin, where the legislation was passed with Representative Gerald Nash, it's now not the men, but the measures taken against them that are infamous.
The starvation order, or the list, as it has become known, was probably one of the most vindictive measures introduced by any Irish government, in fact, during the early years of the state. Effectively, what it meant and what it resulted in is the treatment of those who effectively deserted the Irish army to fight Nazism. It treated them like pariahs as opposed to heroes. If I can use the example, only a handful of miles up the road across the border in Northern Ireland, those who served in Europe, who served in the Far East and elsewhere, were treated like heroes. And only 20 miles down the road, they were treated in a less than satisfactory way.
Do you know what this is, John? It's called the list.
Our personnel of defence forces dismissed from
Dismissed for desertion. Now, this is a list of all those people who did what you did, which was to desert the Irish army.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you on that list?
I don't know, but I am.
Did you used to live in Cork before the war?
Oh, I did, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did you live in Blackpool?
The list was officially confidential, so perhaps it's not surprising that, until we showed it to him, ex-Irish Guardsman John Stout didn't know of its existence, but he certainly felt its effects. On his return home, he was cold-shouldered by the community and couldn't get a job, however hard he tried. To the majority of his fellow countrymen, it was clear that John and the thousands of his comrades were very much persona non grata.
Well, you are on the list, and here's your entry. If you see over there, there's your Irish Army number, E416005.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And there's your name and your address, 39 Spring Lane.
Yeah.
And the date that they dismissed you.
You had a tough time getting a job.
Yeah.
But I think you more so. Yeah. Well, this is very interesting now, because there's Shields here, and Shields was my grandmother's, yeah, on the other side, her name.
Yes.
There's about 5,000 names on there.
Yeah, I suppose so.
5,000.
What they did is to check. If someone applied for the job, they checked the names against that list. And if your name was on the list, you're banned.
Jesus.
So you automatically didn't get the job.
Yeah.
Well, what they'd done to us was wrong, and I know that in my heart. What they'd done to us was wrong.
And how do you feel about being... I mean, you had this amazing war, you showed great bravery, you come back to Ireland, and you're just a dirty deserter.
Oh, yeah.
How do you feel about that?
You know, we desert some, and that's it. They never took him. Why we done it, like?
You couldn't get a job with the electricity supply board. You couldn't get a job with a local authority, with a health board. You're excluded from such positions, which would have given relative comfort to a lot of families. Looking at the Dáil debates, the Irish Parliament debates at the time, in many respects, it fell along party lines. The Fine Gael party, and I think some in the Labour party, my own party, didn't support the list and effectively tried to get it revoked, whereas De Valera's Fianna Fáil government, which with a much more nationalist and insular bent, were the people who were responsible.
They wanted Germany to win. A lot of people here wanted Germany to win the war.
A lot of Irish people wanted Germany.
Yeah, oh yeah. Oh yeah, they were dead up against the British.
And when you say people look down at you, did they cold-shoulder you? Did they insult you? I mean, what was life like?
Cold-shoulder, mostly, like, you know.
They wouldn't speak to you?
Yeah. I had trouble finding work, all right, yeah.
People turned you away?
People didn't take kindly to hear me, to me being the British Army, like, you know.
The impact of the starvation order was harsh and immediate for returning servicemen and their families, like that of Paddy Reid.
The thing that kind of, for me, is interesting, the psychological effects on the family. Because for 7 years, we rarely saw him. He couldn't find work, so he had to scour the countryside working black, you know, in the black economy for farmers, picking turnips or whatever it was, you know. And the money was absolute crap, you know, not enough to feed a family. We simply couldn't afford to live in anything that was halfway decent. We couldn't afford it, you know. So we ended up moving from one slum area to another. I remember crying because there was, you know, my mother would try, but particularly this day there would be enough, you know, maybe a slice of bread or something, that would be it, you know. No proper clothing, no proper heating. It was tough. It was really, really, yeah, that was hurt. Even now I think about it, it's just too painful. And I think for my dad, and certainly for my mother, there was a feeling that, you know, these men had fought bravely and should come back to be hurt continually. And that's how I describe it, a continuous hurt.
These things were referred to as starvation orders. Could that ever have literally been a reality?
Yes. I can only speak to my own experience that there was no food in the house for days on end. So we had to go down to what they call the penny dinners, which are food kitchens, you know. The overall impression I get from the Irish government's treatment was, we're going to make these guys pay in as cruel a way as possible, and psychologically we're going to mess with their heads, you know.
Phil Farrington had already experienced official cruelty right at the beginning of the war, when he was caught coming home on leave from Britain and thrown into jail full of fellow deserters.
And you were talking to me about the camp in to prison in Cork, where you were put for desertion when you were only about 17 or 18. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I'd be more than about 19, maybe.
And the food that they gave you, when I was a small kid, you told me, you used to end up eating eggshells. You were so hungry.
Oh, yeah, what you say? You'd be hungry. I'd shove you into the cell.
Phil Farrington spent his time here in a military prison in Cork, in one of its bleak Victorian jail cells. Deserters were regularly beaten if they didn't work hard enough, and some men committed suicide, fed on starvation rations and treated with contempt by their guards.
The trouble is, Ethan.
They throw the food on the floor.
That was right. And you have to pick it up and eat it.
You were so starved you had to pick it up off the floor.
Yeah. Young man, so that was it.
Immediately he was released, Phil Farrington skipped the country and signed up again with the British Army, this time joining the Pioneer Corps. Seeing action on the Normandy beaches and in the push towards Nazi Germany, helping liberate the first of the death camps.
Beyond the barrier was a whirling cloud of dust. The dust of thousands of slowly moving people, laden in itself with the deadly typhus germ. And with the dust was a smell sickly and thick, the smell of death and decay, of corruption and filth. I passed through the barrier and found myself in the world of a nightmare.
When the war was over, however, Phil Farrington also found work virtually impossible to find, and so his family too duly suffered. And in all the years since the war, his fears of the list have never gone away.
You couldn't explore these issues because they were not to be talked about. So when I grew up, my father would say to me, shh, don't talk, you know, about certain aspects of life.
He was still worried, was he?
Yeah, always. But I say, but Dad, I'm not looking for you at 90. But their fear was still there, you know. I think it's held them back, but I think it transcends through families. And I think if your father's held back by issues, then it's brought into the children. We were all stigmatized.
Despite his desertion, at least Phil Farrington got to keep his children. Because, according to Irish Senator Mary Ann O'Brien, a far worse fate was to befall the offspring of all too many Irishmen who served with the British.
Those, indeed, that were killed and that weren't lucky enough to return home, appallingly enough, their children. They found themselves in such dire times that, let's say, the mummies of these children just didn't have them, were destitute, had nothing left to support themselves or their children. So the children ended up in specialised industrial schools like Golden Bridge, and they had a special little code added to the end of their names, which means they received specially cruel treatment. I mean, my God, can you believe? I mean, this is not so long ago.
This is Golden Bridge Industrial School. It's about 6 miles out of central Dublin. And it's to schools like this, all over Ireland, that hundreds of the sons and daughters of deserters were sent. They would appear in court, a magistrate's court. They would be sentenced to be detained here, and they could be detained in places like this for several years. It's a grim-looking Victorian building, even today, attached to a church. With me is Robert Widders, author of a book about the Irish deserters called Spitting on a Soldier's Grave. What would life be like for the children when they arrived here, Robert?
This is one of the saddest aspects of the whole grim story. Beatings with rubber truncheons were commonplace within the industrial school system. I still find it distressing when I talk to survivors of this system. For instance, the treatment for skin diseases, and of course skin diseases were very common because these children were malnourished and denied hygienic facilities. So the nuns would take a stiff brush, hold the child down, and scrub the skin until the skin was removed.
What would they do in here all those days, all those months, all those years that they were detained?
In the more isolated and rural areas, in some cases the children were actually hired out to work in the fields for farmers. In more urban areas, then they might be employed, for instance, in this place, they would have been employed after what limited education they got during the day. They'd be employed making rosary beads. The conditions in these schools for all of the unfortunate children who were incarcerated in them was abysmal. However, for the children of British soldiers, it was especially bad. And I have a school register, and looking back at this, at the beautiful copper plate writing of the children's names, and I won't, but Sinead, Dee, and Mary, so on. And alongside two of the names are the initials SS, which indicates child of a British soldier, and it also indicates that that child is to be singled out for special abuse. It's quite awful to contemplate how, within a system where physical and sexual abuse was the norm anyway, how it could be any worse. I can't imagine how badly those poor infants were treated.
One of those whose childhood from aged 8 was spent at perhaps the most notorious of the industrial schools, Artane in Dublin, was Thomas Bonner. His father was with the RAF. Housing 1,000 boys and run by the Christian Brothers, he says beatings and sexual abuse was a daily occurrence.
They had straps about 12 inches long, with about three strips of leather. And sometimes in that leather they'd have keys. And then they would box you round the ears and then perhaps put you over a table and beat you across the backside.
And what did you have to do to deserve this?
Well, you only had to get something wrong or being inattentive at school. And if you weren't on cue, he'd find you out. And he would systematically beat you. You're always frightened that something was around the corner. Every Saturday we had a shower, and you queued up. You went in there, you had to take all your clothes off, and the brother would come round. He might beat you in the shower and abuse you. And that went on all the time. If they took a shine to one of the boys, that was it. They'd abuse them.
And could the boys do nothing?
How could they talk to? They couldn't talk to anybody. They were there for the duration.
It's unbelievable, and no one knew or no one said anything about this.
No, because you couldn't speak out against the Catholic Church at that time. They took away their spirit, they took away their adventure, they took away their outlook on life and left them traumatised forevermore.
And it's so ironic that their fathers had fought so hard to enter in one of the most atrocious wars in the history of the human race and had freed all those poor people from the concentration camps in Belsen, and yet their own children were subjected to a similar type of concentration camp back at home in Ireland, just because their fathers had, in inverted commas, deserted the Irish army.
One of the most iconic buildings anywhere in Ireland is the old GPO building here in O'Connell Street. Bullet holes from British soldiers firing on Irish rebels can still be seen in its walls. It's almost a sacred spot for Irish republicanism. And yet, it's here every week that Peter Mulvaney stands behind his table of leaflets and petition sheets, telling passers-by about the list of Irishmen who fought and suffered with the British.
Emergency powers order in relation to this was introduced for political expediency.
I'll sign, yeah.
You didn't sign the petition?
Yeah.
What do you make of it?
Yeah, I think it's very bad.
There were some of them didn't come back. They stayed in England. Like that aunt of mine now, she stayed in England. I don't think they felt they fitted in, you know.
And well, they couldn't get work if they did come back.
No. And a lot of my mother's friends now, they were killed in Dunkirk. And they just, anybody else that survived, they came back, but they went back again because they just felt the hostility, I think, here, you know.
Because they fought for the British.
Exactly, exactly. It's about time we buried everything and just remembered that those people.
This is meant not to be a petition in a strict sense. People to come along, to be visible. The pardoning process that we're after, really, it's about removing the stigma of that list, because that list can actually be bought on the internet, and there are people that I know, the names, very familiar names in that list, and I mean, people want to leave things behind them, so a pardoning process would not change the history of it, would leave the blame at the politicians and let the outfitters, the one survivors that are left, who opened their wheelchairs with their medals on, with their heads hanging high.
Whether that happens depends on the Irish Minister of Defence, Alan Shatter, who says he is giving active consideration to the matters raised in this programme. According to Senator Marianne O'Brien, however, it's not debate but action that's needed, because for the small band of Irish war heroes still living, all in their late 80s and 90s, time is fast running out.
Well, some of the stories we've heard today, I mean, it would just shock you to your very core. And, you know, we think we're in tough times now, but my gosh, I feel stronger than I ever did. We must take action for these people. I would like to see their situation brought to justice, and I would like to see a full pardon granted both to them and to their families, to give them the comfort they deserve and the peace they deserve.
Families like D-Day hero Phil Farrington's, whose grandson Patrick says the stigma and the fear that the legislation engendered should finally be consigned to history.
A simple pardon, yeah. We've had the Queen over, we've had people up the north at peace, and yeah, we still can't get the Irish lads that fought for the war. We can't get them a thank you or a pardon. It's shocking. Shocking that someone comes back from the war, you know, could have given their life. I know many did that are still blacklisted, and then to be treated the way he was. You know, they didn't run away for a holiday. They weren't making fortunes and gallivanting around Europe. They were running towards guns.
Face the Facts was presented by John Waite and produced by Susan Mitchell.